ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Leora Kornfeld, a woman the legendary author and cultural anthropologist Grant McCracken calls the single smartest person I know on the topic of new economies that are emerging online. And we'll find out why and much more in today's episode. Leora, thank you so much for joining us today. I am so excited to talk to you. Let's start by giving me and the audience the executive summary of your story and all the different hats that you wear, just to set the stage for our conversation.
Gee, how do I explain myself? You know, it's like Alice in Wonderland. What did she say? I've changed many times since this morning, and that's sort of what it feels like. I look at my life as, you know, some people look at their life as sort of like being on a single page, and I look at mine as a series of chapters in a book. Sometimes it's not even the same book. So I've done everything from being a radio DJ to being a case writer at Harvard Business School to teaching to working as a consultant on industry reports about the internet to, you know, early on in my life having worked in retail, which was actually very valuable as I look back. And I've done a startup, so I've covered a lot of the landscape.
Fantastic. And I think that that's, that brings us to a great place because you really do sort of have this cross-section of knowledge. And as Grant McCracken said, you're the single smartest person he knows on the topic of new economies that are emerging online. And that's...
Nobody can live up to that. Nobody.
Oh, well, so you better be really smart. Anyway, what I'd like to first start off on is... talking about streaming revenue models. And I'd like to get your take on the future of some of these revenue models. You know, does the music industry continue to depend on freemium or subscription?
Just with regard to the music industry, well, there's a lot of interesting things going on there. So if we look at something like Spotify, for example, which has sort of become the de facto go-to place where we get music. It's interesting, just a couple of years ago, we were all on Pandora, and Pandora, nobody talks about it anymore, right? And, you know, they had, what, something like 80 to 100 million users. So, you know, you can get that far, and things can change quite quickly, which I think is a characteristic feature of the internet economy, right? The ability to go from, you can't even say 0 to 60, it's more like 0 to 100 million very quickly, but you can also slide very quickly. But with Spotify, what's interesting there is they've got a user base of around 100 million people, and they've got about 30 million paying customers, so 30%, which is astonishing for a freemium model. Most freemium models, when they work, when they actually get to profitability, are in a low single digit. That's all you need, is about 3 to 5% to make it work. And those unicorn companies that you read about all the time, the startup companies that have valuations of over a billion, many of them operate on freemium, and their hope is to get to that, to give away lots and lots of stuff and hope that with some additional features, 3% of the people will pay, and then they're on to a profitable business model. So then you're probably wondering, well, okay, that's 3% for freemium. What's going on in the music business? You just told me that Spotify has 30% people paying. Yeah, they do. And they're still hemorrhaging money. Mm. Do you know why that is?
No, why? Tell me.
Do you want to even guess?
No.
You're not going to be that person that puts their hand up in class and then says, gee, I wish I didn't put my hand up in class.
No.
But you know what it is? It's very interesting because, and it's one of the issues with the music industry. And, you know, I worked in the music industry starting as a little kid working at record stores and then campus radio stations and commercial radio and public broadcasting. So I've seen it through, many different lenses from many different points of view. And the issue around the music industry is that all the models are based on the legacy system. And the legacy system is one in which there's a 97% failure rate, and that's pretty much true across all of the entertainment industry, right? Books, movies, TV, music. It's the 3% of the people. It's the, you know, it's Bruno Mars and Drake and Adele and those very few people that carry everybody else on the label. So what's going on there is that there are legacy structures and legacy contracts in place whereby the people who own the rights are getting the lion's share of the revenues, right? And I'm sure you've heard about people saying on Spotify, artists are getting a fraction of a penny per play. And yes, that's true. They are. There's been an incredible amount of evaporation of value. It's not the old business that it used to be. The people who are doing well are the ones who don't have those intermediaries to whom the bulk of the funds are going. But on the other hand, it's also hard to be that person who doesn't have the intermediary. That means you've got to do a lot of stuff yourself, which a lot of people aren't equipped to do, aren't prepared to do. So we're very much in a time of flux. But, you know, if we're looking at something like Spotify with 30% of the user base paying, and, you know, it's $10 a month, and they're still, in fact, not only are they not making money, they're losing more money each month.
Right. Which then begs the question, is the pricing right or is it sustainable? I mean, you know, at what point do you pull the plug? When you're talking about other revenue models, is that you've written about blockchain. First, can you explain in simple terms what that is?
Nobody really understands blockchain. Just like nobody really understands Bitcoin, right? Really, and Bitcoin is built on blockchain. I mean, the easiest way to describe it, and I am by no means an expert, is that it's a decentralized ledger of transactions on the internet. So there's some musicians using that, and what it allows them to do in the case of musicians when they upload files online is that you can embed into the audio file who holds the rights and how all the licenses work. So all of the audio files are downloaded and paid for, then the money can flow at the same time to the holders of the rights. So it's very early days in blockchain, but you know, there's certainly people who are saying that this is going to be a radical rewriting of many industries. A lot of people are seeing that it's the future of finance and banking. That's one possibility, but you mentioned things like, you know, is Spotify going to pull the plug and go away? It absolutely will not. And there's a couple of reasons. The majority stakeholders in Spotify are also the music labels. In the case of Napster, it was a free for all, right? There were no permissions, there were no labels involved, there was no money being exchanged. And you know, Napster could have gone into agreements with music labels or rights holders, but they chose not to. Right. Sean Fanning, who started it, was given the opportunity. He was approached by a lot of people. And what he wanted to do was change the world, he said. Right. He wasn't interested in making money. And that's very interesting. So if you look 15 years later at what Spotify is doing, they're changing the world and making a bunch of money. Well, you know, they're making a bunch of money internally. Right. The people who work there and the shareholders and things like that. And eventually it will make money.
Right. Right.
Eventually it will. It's a matter of, you know, does that mean they're going to get acquired? Does it mean that, you know, Google or Facebook has to acquire them in order for them to make money? Maybe it does.
Right. Do switching from music to video content, those are my clients are storytellers, content providers, networks and cable channels. Do these video publishers, do you think they continue to focus on ad-supported models, or do they move to subscription models? Where do you think that's headed?
And again, there's been so much draining of value out of any sort of publishing industry where, you know, 10 years ago, somebody even told me, 10, 15 years ago, and I'm sure you've had the same experience, if somebody told you that the world's greatest, most reliable encyclopedia was going to be free online and written by nobody in particular, would you have believed them?
No.
No, right? You can only laugh, right? We can only laugh. And it's the same that can be said for so much online information, that there's people doing you know, people used to say you get what you pay for, but actually that's not true on the internet, right? That's one of the problems. You can get fantastic stuff on the internet that's not only great, but it's often better than what the legacy organizations are providing. And that's because we have the scarcity abundance issue, right? What used to be scarce is now abundant, and people have other motivations for publishing online. But all that said, there is evidence that a number of businesses that used to be the free for all are now switching their business model. So Medium, the blogging platform, is talking about going to a pay model. SoundCloud for music is talking about going to a pay model. There is a European company called Blendle, B-L-E-N-D-L-E. Do you know about them?
Yeah, with the micropayments for the content. And if you're not pleased with it, you can even get a refund. That's that one, right?
Yeah. You can pay something like, 9 cents to read an article from any newspaper in the world. And if you don't like it, you can get your 9 cents back, which is pretty great. But they now have a million users. Right, a million paying users. They just hit that milestone, I think, this week or last week, because they got traction early on in Europe, and we just weren't sure how it was going to work in the U.S. So, you know, they have a long way to go. But the fact that people are willing to do that shows that there are people who understand that there's a value to the work created by, you know, the Washington Post, the Guardian, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, because, as you know, that's expensive content to produce.
Absolutely. I think that that's the thing. Interestingly, I was at an event and a woman from SoundCloud was speaking, and she was talking about joyful spend and your willingness to spend for something as long as it's a premium experience, as long as it's premium content, and defining what that content is. I think in terms of, you know, print news media, you want something that you can trust has been researched, fact-checked, is legitimate.
Well, there's that, but there's also the type of funding that we're seeing going on platforms like Patreon, you know, for subscriptions for podcasts, for example. So there's a guy here in Toronto who does a podcast, and he pulls in about $15,000 a month, and he's been able to hire additional people to do that. You know, I mean, that's a pretty great thing. You know, Kickstarter they've raised well over $1 billion. So people are willing to pay for things. So it's either, like you say, the high credibility stuff or the high passion stuff. The interesting statistic I came across, and this one really floored me, you know, GoFundMe.com? GoFundMe now raises $100 million a month.
Wow.
Yeah, these are staggering numbers. So there's something about getting people, you get people involved emotionally. And in a way, that's what, you know, Etsy and Kickstarter are too, right? There's a high emotional aspect to it, and there's the idea that there's something very highly individual going on.
Right, a high level of engagement and individualized engagement where you feel personally connected. It's interesting, you also see in terms of charity, like Donors Choose, where you have citizen philanthropy put to very good use in very small increments, $5 increments, very transparent, very effective. One thing I'm also interested in, you've written about walled gardens, these closed ecosystems on the internet, and how Facebook, like early AOL, is this walled garden, and everything gets pushed through the feed to the consumer. Now, do you think, I had never really thought about it that way, do you think that Facebook can continue as a walled garden? Can it continue like that? I mean, we look at AOL, we look at Yahoo, those did not work very well. What differentiates Facebook? Why will it work or not?
Well, you could say it's interesting to look at. You mentioned AOL and Yahoo, and you know, for a long time they actually worked very well, right? Both of those companies pioneered a lot of things, and they created businesses that had a lot of value. Yes, the value went down over the years. In some ways, you know, it's amazing that they lasted as long as they did. What's interesting there is to look at who acquired them. Verizon,
right?
That's a cell phone operator. So what's going on there is that the cell phone companies realize that in order to compete, because that's a high churn business. What do they have to do in order to compete? They can't just be providing connectivity. They have to provide an overall consumer experience that involves information and entertainment. To the question about Facebook and walled garden, it's an interesting thing because as long as they're a walled garden, they have a greater chance of higher profits, and they are doing phenomenally well at a time when very few media companies are. In fact, the only media companies, you know, having that kind of growth anywhere near that level, of course, are Facebook and Google. But, you know, as a walled garden, they are essentially the home page of the internet for many, many people. They have about 1 billion users, of which I won't even venture a guess how many people use it as a home page, but I'm going to say, you know, at least half of them do. And the difference between that and, say, you know, when we used to go to AOL or Yahoo as our home pages in the late 90s is that we only had the information streams that were being pushed to us by those companies. Whereas once you're a social platform, there's no sort of central agenda being pushed at you. Arguably, the algorithm does some of that. And yes, that's true. But the difference with the social platforms is that multitude of voices. And again, if you ever told me, this is like the Wikipedia analogy, if you ever told me that I'd go to some website that everybody that I went to high school and university with is going to be on there, you know, blabbing about everything from their kids to bad customer service to a good meal that they had, and that I'd be on that every day for hours, I wouldn't believe you. I'd say, why would I go there? Why, you know, why wouldn't I just go to nytimes.com if I want information? I can get anything on the internet. But again, it has to do with, like you say, high engagement. It's those sort of counterintuitive things that the internet brings us that we really can't anticipate until we have the experience. And then you see how, frankly, addictive it can become.
Right, right. What does it mean, though, that so much information and so much time is being spent on services that are controlled by two corporations, you know, Google and Facebook/Instagram? Like, if you think of how many apps are on people's phones and how many they actually use, two private businesses sitting on top of an awful lot of data about us. Is that a good thing? Is that is that exchange okay?
Well, what's interesting there is that, you know, people used to complain about sort of the mass media, and it was always, you know, the big five or the big four, whether that was television networks or movie studios or publishing houses, whatever. And then we had, you know, the promise of the early promise of the internet, which is that everything is going to be just blown wide open and there's opportunities for everyone and nothing gets in the way of anyone publishing, which is absolutely true, right? There is no excuse. If you want to have a blog or a podcast or an ebook or any of those things, right, your Instagram account, you can do all that stuff. People with selfie sticks who are now little media companies. So all of those things are possible. The issue then becomes the overabundance and how does anything get noticed in that environment? And, you know, one of the answers is aggregation. Aggregation, some people call it curation, and that becomes a type of filtering and a taste graph for people. So, you know, once aggregation starts, it's sort of like an avalanche, right? It acquires velocity as it goes, and then you have the giants, right? You have the Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, you know, that handful of companies. Verizon is now one of them, as we discussed. I don't think it's so much a matter of, you know, is it a good thing or a bad thing? We could talk about that for the rest of our lives. I think what's going on is that, you know, probably more like 10 years ago, people talked about the long tail, and the long tail was going to be great news because you could take the business model of Amazon, which was outside of shelf space. You could carry an unlimited number of products, and that's good for consumers, and that's good for creators, too. But one of the things I think that's happened is what some people call I've heard it referred to as the smiling curve. So you have to visualize the smile or the barbell, which means – if you can visualize, you know, the long tail. So instead of it petering out at the end, it gets the little bump again at the end. So that means like ultra niche stuff can work. And then in the middle, you have a bunch of stuff that really doesn't do well. And then at the head of the tail, you have the blockbuster stuff. So I prefer to look at it that way. And I see a lot of really interesting examples of that.
Right, right. Yeah, and the influence too that used to, you know, where do you go for your the leading edge of the culture and where things are going artistically, it used to be sort of unidirectional, and now you see some back and forth where you have the big players co-opting the edgy stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, another way I look at it is that everybody used to either want to be pro or have to be pro. Right. You had to have that sort of slick, corporate, polished pro look. So and then we have what we have now because of user generated content catching on in that from the bottom up, trickle up way. Now we have pros who are trying to look like the amateurs because the amateurs are the ones who have been able to attract attention, clicks and eyeballs. Like if you listen to podcasts, have you noticed there's a thing called, it's almost podcast voice, where nobody wants to sound like a radio person. Everybody wants to sound like Ira Glass, right? They kind of creak. And like the person that you know, who talks like that, right? And that's what people want to sound like now. I listen to hours and hours of podcasts, and everybody has podcast voice, and nobody sounds like the radio person anymore. You know? And you see it in YouTube, and you see it in TV. You see it everywhere now.
Well, I think that speaks to the desire for authenticity. And people use that as a proxy for authenticity, that it's, you know, it's different. And so then different becomes uniform, uniformly different, strange in a uniform way. I'm also, you know, one of the other things that I find interesting is how everybody talks about Twitter. It's such a failure. When you think about how many users it has and at what point, you know, what happens if you achieve maximum saturation, you know, Amazon and how many Prime subscribers there are, eventually you're going to really max out. And then what? What happens next?
There is a wonderful book on this very topic by a guy named Douglas Rushkoff. Have you ever encountered him?
I have not. I'm writing it.
He's been writing on this topic for 20 years, but his most recent book is called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. And it's about how the promise of the economy of the internet has kind of come back to bite us. And he talks specifically about the case of Twitter, so I'm glad you brought that up. They are a company that makes over $2 billion a year in revenue, right? I said, and that's billion with a B. You know, yeah, I know, you got to laugh, right? How many companies actually have that kind of revenue? And as he points out, you know, how many companies in the business of 140 character messages, right? Again, it's one of those things you never thought would take off. They've got hundreds of millions of users.
Right.
So all of these things that you and I are talking about today have to do with the fact that everyone has access, right? Universal upload, universal access at no cost. Almost no cost to anyone.
Ah, yes. There's always a cost somewhere.
Well, there's always
there?
A cost. There's always a cost, right?
Yes, yes. All of our secret data. Well, I'm mindful of the time, and I have a couple of words I want to fire through, and I just want you to give me your reaction off the cuff, whatever it makes you think of, sort of free association. You ready?
Sure.
Okay. Facebook.
Can't believe it started in a dorm room.
Okay. Google.
That you just never know where these world-changing innovations are going to come from.
Okay. Next word, Twitter.
I'm going to go back to what we just talked about, $2 billion a year in revenue.
And a failure.
Depends how you brand it. Depends how we define those things. Right?
Right, right. YouTube.
Access for all.
Okay. Ad blockers.
The People's Rebellion.
Okay. Art.
Art. Art is, it's somebody else's quote, but it's the lie that tells the truth.
Ooh, I like that. Okay. How about AR?
It can bring the magic and power of digital to the real world around you.
Cool. All right, last one. Aren't you relieved? AI.
I just read this article saying that IBM's Watson managed to come up with a treatment for a leukemia patient that like a group of the top 30 doctors in the world couldn't come up with, because it was able to detect a particular pattern about a particular detail. So, I mean, when you see things like that happening, that's pretty great news.
That is. It really is. Okay, now switching gears just a little bit, having a little bit of fun. So what are you watching on Netflix? What are you binging?
I actually don't binge that much. So what I've been watching is The Get Down, that series, which I've only watched one episode of it. I had hoped for more, but I have to watch the rest of it to get a sense. It is absolutely cinematically beautiful, gorgeous, the kind of thing you would only generally see on a big screen at a theater. I'm always just watching obscure documentaries, one about like video piracy in Romania. That one's on Netflix. I just go into basically into the documentary section of Netflix, and I'm happy for a long, long time.
The sort of the very last thing is, what's up next for you?
Well, it depends. Do you mean in life? What are you working on now?
What are you working on now?
I wish you could see my screen. A very, very involved spreadsheet. I just taught two terms at the Schulich School of Business at York University here in Toronto. And now I am back working on an industry report. And it's my third time doing it. And whenever I tell people about this study, they just sort of look at me and their eyes go a bit sort of glazed. And then I say, yes, that's the right response. And this is a report that determines the economic value of the internet to the U.S. economy.
Oh,
that's really okay. That's where we have to say pause. Yeah. Are your eyes glazing over? Because that would be the right response. It's a fascinating and often infuriating project. Well, exasperating project to work on, because it's very, very difficult.
I can't imagine how you even, where do you start?
Well, exactly. Building on some of the stuff we've talked about today, to see the companies that have grown since then and the ones that have declined since then and the ones who were like a little footnote last time who are now dominating in certain industries, absolutely fascinating. You just never know with this stuff. You really just never know.
Right, right. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really, really, really appreciate it.
So welcome. It's been fun. Hopefully you got what you needed.
I think so.
I feel like we could talk, you know, for the rest of our lives about this stuff.
Well, it's funny, when I was reading, you know, some of your blog and looking at your stuff, I was like, oh my goodness, I could talk to this woman forever. She's got so many things to say. So
You know where I am.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have been indispensable to bringing this to life. As usual, first and foremost is the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thanks, Rob. Our production team over at Microfame Media, thank you. Grant McCracken for recommending today's guest. And of course, most importantly, Leora Kornfeld for participating today. And last but not least, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you next week, right here on Up Next.